A spicy denunciation.
The state of these,
murmured Orso as he was herded past the new statues on what used to be the Kingsway. The freezing weather and now the soggy thaw had not been kind to them. The nose of one of the giant nursing mothers had already dropped off, broken lumps of it scattered about her pedestal. There were some troubling cracks in her bust besides. Probably that would drop off next, braining some unfortunate passerby, crushed by giant tits. It was the way Tunny had always wanted to go.
Rizzino brought some sculptor over from Styria to remake them, said Hildy, frowning up. But she was tossed off the Tower of Chains along with him, so they got some masons to do it.
Oh, yes.
He vaguely remembered that being discussed by the representatives before court one day. Some young firebrand from the provinces frothing up a fury. An actual sculptor would have been an aristocratic indulgence. There is no task beyond the skill of a proud working man of the Union. He puffed out his cheeks.
By the fates, they can't even destroy things well.
You're saying you miss the old ones? Asked Hildy.
Orso opened his mouth to answer, then paused. As with so many things these days, he had hopelessly mixed feelings. Lord Hoff had once referred to the statues on the Kingsway as the Union's greatest treasure, a celebration of all that was most noble, a true wonder of the world, if patriotic swagger was your fetish. Except they had also, of course, been a total pack of lies, a parade of self-serving arrogance in which Orso would one day have taken his place, where rapacious torturers were celebrated for their compassion, vengeful warmongers praised for their forbearance, heedless do-nothings eulogized for their painstaking care. As if to set the tone for this shameless distortion of history, Baez, the world's most shameless thief, had been literally raised up on a pedestal at both ends for all that he had given the Union.
Which do you prefer? Asked Orso with a shrug. Grand lies or ugly truths?
Reckon we might be better off with neither, muttered Hildy.
Orso had even more mixed feelings about the changes to the Square of Marshals. He tried to keep his chin up and walk with that careless swagger that so annoyed his many guards, but could not seem to prevent his eyes from drifting down, could not help reading the names carved into the flagstones where a parade in his honour once ended. Here and there, melted mounds of candle stubs and decaying wreaths and sodden letters of gratitude had built up impromptu shrines around the names of the most admired martyrs. So many names, thousands upon thousands, and each one a person dead so that he could sit on a golden chair and seem to be in power. Perhaps, fortunately, perhaps not, his attention was soon claimed by the jeering. Winter had drastically reduced the size of the crowds before the court of the people, but the fanatics that remained made up for it by sheer weight of anger, pressing in around the guards, shaking pamphlets and yelling insults. Orso smiled, waved, blew kisses, as he always did.
Too kind, my subjects, to turn out in the cold for me. Too kind.
A sneering woman spat on him, and he clutched it to his stained jacket like a bouquet.
I shall treasure it.
Long live the king! Came a scream.
Oh, no, said Hildy.
Someone had clambered up on one of the broken pedestals near the steps of the court. A flash of the golden sun of the Union on a piece of cloth frantically waved. Rage flashed through the mob.
Long live the...
Cut off in a squawk as he was dragged down. A surge as people struggled to get close enough to participate in the beating. This kind of thing was becoming more and more common. Were these spur-of-the-moment royalists lunatics, simpletons, suicidal? Or had the disappointments of the great change simply piled on them so heavily it induced a kind of mania? Orso was grateful for any support, but could they not support him silently, Open demonstrations of monarchism did no one any good, least of all the monarch himself. In her last message, Teufel had told him that plans were in place, that he should be ready, that it might be a matter of days. He had to smother a surge of nerves at the thought. He leaned close to Hildy to whisper,
"I think Judge is going to put me on trial soon. You've been saying that for weeks. It's getting dangerous. You've been saying that for weeks. And I've been right. Hildy, I mean it. This would be an excellent moment for you to abandon me."
She dropped her voice even further, murmuring through tight lips,
"Your friends will come through."
Orso caught a glimpse of his latest supporter, dragged past insensible, blood in his hair. One of the guards aimed a lazy kick at him. The crowd had fallen on the old flag like wolves on a carcass and were trampling each other in their eagerness to trample it. Corporal Halder surveyed the scene with an air of bored detachment, hands on hips.
"I still hope they will," muttered Orso, "but being realistic, when have you ever done that? The chances of failure are very high."
The closer the day came, indeed, the higher the chances of failure seemed.
"The consequences of failure?"
It was hardly worth spelling them out. He spent every waking moment powerlessly turning them over, after all, and every sleeping moment dreaming about them.
"If they don't come through, you'll know about it when you hear me denouncing you to the court of the people."
Orso smiled.
"That's my girl. Make it a spicy denunciation, though, won't you? None of these droning lists of names we get these days. I want it overflowing with scandal, shocks, and low moral character." "Oh, it'll be a real firecracker," said Hildy. "I'll make 'em shit in the galleries." "Maybe stop short of that. The place smells bad enough as it is."
"Let's go," grunted Halder, nudging Orso up the steps to the court of the people. There had been a time when access to the royal person was governed by a book of rules 4 fingers thick. Now any fool could poke him with impunity. Judge was getting comfortable in the high chair, as Orso was manhandled into the sovereign's cage, but there was a gap on the front benches, where Citizen Brock and his Anglanders would usually have been preening themselves. Orso rather hoped they might have been spicily denounced and dragged off to the House of Purity themselves, but that was probably too much luck to hope for. Luck had really not been falling his way the past couple of decades.
"Silence in the court!"
And the murmur of voices dropped away as Swarbrick strode forwards. He had acquired a blood-red suit of clothes now, having been appointed chief prosecutor for the Great Change. Since the proceedings were less about law than consolatory fantasy and cheap melodrama, no doubt the writer was uniquely qualified.
"After weeks of painstaking investigation," he shrieked, meaning a night spent hauling the latest crop of unfortunates from their beds at random, the loyal servants of the Great Change, meaning the drunken, drugged, and murder-addicted burners, "have ripped a most sinister conspiracy up by the roots and into the light of justice."
Always new conspiracies, always the most sinister, ever more elaborate, fiendish, impossible to disprove. Intrigues that somehow involved Styrians, Gurkish, and Northmen all at once. Schemes that required the enemies of the Great Change to be inscrutable puppet masters and utter idiots simultaneously. Orso wondered what would happen when they had killed everyone. Would Judge try herself last of all in the empty court of the people, sentence herself to death, and fling herself from the Tower of Chains? He gave an entirely inappropriate splutter of laughter at the thought. The shame was he would not live to see it, having been pulped in the dry moat years before. Unless his friend at the House of Purity came through sooner rather than later. His eyes flickered to the latest wretched group being herded to the dock by Captain Broad, and he sat bolt upright. Most prisoners strove to appear humble. It was hard not to, after a few days with meagre food and no bath, in some chilly corner of the Agrient, hastily converted into cells. But the woman at the back of this trio had done the exact opposite, costumed as if for the summer contest at the height of the old regime, all piled red wig, dramatic black silk, and bosomy flounce.
"Celeste Dan Huygen," murmured Orso.
He knew the woman was nobody's fool, so why had she dressed as the villain of this particular pantomime? She stood proudly in the dock, in defiance of the boos, catcalls, and obscene suggestions from the public galleries, but there was a waxy pallor of fear under her overheavy blush. She glanced at Judge, and the ringleader of this demented circus grinned back as she propped her dirty feet on the high table and nodded at her prosecutor to get the righteous work underway.
"Henrik Jost!"
Swarbrick roared at the first prisoner, a portly man with a double chin and a patched waistcoat.
"You stand accused of grand usury and conspiracy. Have you anything to say?"
The man struggled up, looking punch drunk, a large bruise above his eye.
"I admit to serving for a dozen years as a senior lending clerk at the banking house of Valentin Bulk,"
hisses from above.
"But it was considered a respectable trade, entirely respectable. I arranged loans for worthy enterprises, mills and manufactories the breadth of Middleland, establishments that gave employment to many."
"Including businesses and establishments,"
hissed Swarbrick, as though they were the worst excesses of witchcraft, "owned by this woman, Celeste Huygen." A chorus of boos. Some rotten piece of vegetable matter tumbled from above and sprayed juice across the tiles. The banker stared at Celeste. She stared back, breathing hard through flared nostrils.
"Well, yes, but in those days, no one thought of it as a crime."
"Time's no shield from punishment," growled Judge.
"Guilty!"
Just was about to protest, but Sulby leaned over the dock to cuff him across the head and knock him back into his seat. Swarbrick had already swaggered to the next prisoner, a trembly man with a nimbus of wild hair, his eyes bloodshot behind cracked lenses.
"Pieter Nolholm, you stand accused of disloyal pronouncements, royalist sympathies, and conspiracy to incite riot. Have you anything to say?"
"Absolutely."
He sprang up, waving a fistful of flapping papers scrawled on both sides.
"I have established a watertight defense,"
grumbles from the galleries as he perched his lenses on his wispy pate and began rummaging through his mismatched pages.
"I fear there was some damage caused by damp during the last search of my cell."
"I thought it was watertight,"
some wag called from the upper gallery. Laughter.
"Ah, yes."
The old man cleared his throat, puffing up his chest to read from notes scrawled on an old shirt, declaiming in an orator's wail,
"Was it not Juvens himself who spoke unto the Samnites, 'Justice is more than punishment, more than vengeance'?"
He shuffled his papers again, a couple of scraps fluttering to the floor.
"And was it Bialoweld, or no, my mistake, one moment, I think it was Verturio who said,
'We're not here for a fucking history lesson,'"
sneered Judge, hammering at the table.
"He's guilty too."
"But I have scarcely commenced my preamble."
Broad tore the sheaf of scrawlings from Nolholm's hands and shoved him back down. He missed his seat and sprawled on the floor, paper bags, candle wrappers, and scribbled-on sheet music drifting about him.
"Celeste Dan Huygen,"
snapped Swarbrick. She rose, an ill-looking blotchiness across her collarbones, but her fists clenched like those of a prize-fighter about to enter the ring.
You stand accused of profiteering, speculation, exploitation, and conspiracy. Charges vague enough to be impossible to prove or disprove, as they always were. Have you anything to...
I wish to make denunciations,
she blurted, as though desperate to get in before she missed her chance. She did not even bother to protest her innocence. In that, she was probably wise. Innocence was wasted on the court these days. Judge hungrily licked her lips.
By all means.
Celeste spilled names like a broken cask spills wine. Her entire acquaintance came out in a burbling rush. Several also knew had already been executed. Tears began to trickle down her face, leaving black powder tracks all the way to her spit-flecked lips. She denounced friends, partners, family members. Boris Huygen, her cousin, shriveled into his seat with characteristic cowardice. It came as no surprise these days, of course. Also had seen courage in that dock and inspiring camaraderie and towering dignity. He had also seen brothers denounce their sisters, wives denounce their husbands, parents denounce their children. Judge started to frown. She shifted impatiently in her chair. She curled her lip and reached for her hammer.
I denounce Savin Brock, screeched Celeste.
Orso felt as if his guts had suddenly fallen out of his arse, and he was not the only one on whom the name fell heavily. There was no cheer, only a disbelieving mutter. The ex-nobleman looked grim. This was an attack on their leader, an attack on them. And Savin had made herself popular recently at the other end of the social scale. She had fed people, clothed people, brought them fuel in the bleak winter when the burners had brought them nothing but corpses. Swarbrick glanced worriedly over at Judge, but Judge waved him eagerly on.
Of what do you accuse her?
Of profiteering, speculation, and usury on the grandest of scales. It is a fact that for years she exploited the working men and women of the union for her own profit, that she conspired with her father, Archlector Glockta, that she conspired with bankers, Gurkish agents, and Styrian spies.
Celeste lifted a trembling finger to point straight at Orso.
It is a fact that she conspired with the king.
He stared back in shocked upset.
Everyone knows she bloody conspired against me. Then why did you spare her and her husband the noose? Shrieked Celeste.
It was a good question, one to which Orso had himself struggled to find a satisfactory answer. Celeste was less circumspect.
Because it is a fact that Savin Brock was for years the king's lover.
Orso sat back frowning on his stool as the whispers fluttered about the public galleries. That one was harder to deny with much conviction. They were memories he still often guiltily caught himself enjoying after all.
Not only that, it is a fact,
Celeste spat the word with a kind of savage triumph,
that Savin Brock is the king's sister.
Orso felt the colour drain from his face. Probably he should have lied his head off. That was what everybody else did in here. But he was taken too much by surprise. Everyone was.
It is a fact!
Celeste was screaming now, spit flying, broken voice echoing.
That Savin Brock is the bastard daughter of King Jezal the First!
There was a breathless silence in the court as people struggled to make sense of what they were hearing. The representatives sat gawping on their benches. The public galleries gave a collective gasp. Captain Broad stood, flask frozen just short of his mouth. Judge sat bolt upright in her chair, mouth twisted into a delighted grin. In her last message, Teufel had told him that it might be a matter of days. It looked as if days might be too long.
Now that, breathed Hildy,
is a spicy denunciation.